Well, now we're at the session where I get to listen to two of us that are here. And I'm really happy that the gentleman I approached and asked them if they would share tonight both agreed and both were happy to do it. And I'm not going to say anything other than I know you're going to enjoy the next hour. And please join me in welcoming our first friend, Mike Red Dog. Come on up, Mike.
Hi, I'm Mike Redman. I'm an alcoholic. I'm just thrilled to be here. When Sandy called up, it was my 60th birthday. The belly button. Right. And it was just like blew me away that that he'd even that he'd want to hear what I have to say. This thing is the third time I've been to this retreat, and every time it's just been better and better, and for me, I'm pretty slow, so I go home and I listen to the CDs about 20 or 30 times, and then I finally get it all down pat, so okay, well, that's what he's talking about, that's what he meant, and then I get here and everything changes. So my brain's mush, and only because it is. I come from a nice family in the Seattle area. Dad was a businessman. Mom was helped him with the business. She had a little variety store for a while. Neither one of them were alcoholics. My dad had alcoholism in his family and his brothers, and so did my mom. My one uncle was killed in a hunting accident in downtown Burnsville, North Carolina. Yeah. My grandfather was a sheriff, and they were busting stills, and my uncle was selling all the booze. I get it. So, there's a little of that there, and I don't think that has anything to do with my alcoholism. Matter of fact, I'm sure it doesn't. I started drinking in high school, 13, 14 years old when you first get to high school, whatever that is. The thing for me is alcohol always did for me. It made me more than, it made me what I wanted to be or what I hoped I could be when I was drunk enough. It was fine. And then, so I did it. I drank a lot of years without a whole lot of trouble, without a lot of repercussions. A few little incidents. Remember one night I was driving across the floating bridge in Seattle in the wrong lane. And kind of tore up my dad's new Mustang, and he was pretty upset about that. A few deals like that, but nothing real big. Got out of high school, and I went into this community college. I was going to learn how to fly, and I'd already had a pilot's license. I started that very early. I suffer from aviation besides alcoholism. And Sandy well knows when you're bitten with that bug, it's a hell of a disease. It's the only thing that could get me sober, to be quite honest with you. It's the only thing that could get me sober. That's eventually what happened. I went to this school, and I was no longer under the reign of my parents' house and all that other stuff, so it opened the door, and it was a lot of fun. I took it pretty seriously for about a week. And I started, it was the weekends only, and then it was the week, and then it was all week, and a few instances with the police over there. I outran them a couple of times with a car that I had. It was fairly fast, and they always knew who I was. And they'd come and talk to me later on, and I didn't get the tickets and stuff for that. And around that time, I ran into some other substances that would kind of enhance things a little bit. I was having a lot of fun, and I knew I might be getting on the edge of having too much fun a couple times, but it really wasn't a problem. There were no real consequences for anything I was doing, so it was good. And I got my commercial license and all this stuff, and while I was there, I had like a 0.64 grade average. I'm really not an intellect and real big on schooling. And so I got, you know, I what happened was I was got thrown out of school because I was, you know, wasn't paying too much attention. I have all did not complete F's and then two A's in the flight labs. But you could fly an airplane for $12 an hour, do or solo. So it was a great deal because it was half the price of anywhere else. And so that's why I went to college. And 2 months of that, I was 42 and 1A and the first lottery. And I pretty much knew what was going to happen to me. I got involved in a horrible motorcycle crash when I was earlier in my life. And that exempted me from the services because I put my hip up into my lung and a few other deals. And I was out on a motorbike when I wasn't supposed to be on it. My drinking started taking on some pretty good proportions. I remember I had a really great collection of beer caps. You know, we did all the counters in the room with in the apartment I lived in with little beer caps, and we spelled stuff out and did all that. You know, that's and just normal stuff. I had an opportunity to move to Alaska in 1969, and I jumped on it and I went up there and. You know, so I got up there, and my alcoholism, it started to go real good, and then it stepped back because I couldn't afford it. I mean, literally, I was making $600 a month, and I was working, you know, 7/12 is basically what it was. So we'd go to the corner store, or the corner bar, I should say, the old Tradewinds, and we'd drink down there. And I tell you the rest of the story. When I first got to Alaska, you could drink till 5 in the morning. And it's heaven for that. It was just absolutely wonderful. I got up there in the winter, so it's dark all the time. You don't know if it's 5 a.m. or 5 p.m., you know, in the winter. And you come out of the bars, and it was just wonderful. You know, I found home. I got beat up a few times in the first 2 weeks, and a few other deals happened that weren't real pleasant. And, you know, I sat back after 2 weeks thinking my nose broke twice, my jaw broke twice, and another deal. And I just said, you know, I'm home. And I've been there ever since. These are my kind of people. And I started living that lifestyle. But as I said, from the very beginning, I didn't make enough money to drink enough. And I had a friend who was a good pool player. And so we'd go to the Tradewinds, and he'd play pool, and I'd drink off what he won. It was a real good deal, you know. And I'd load his airplane because he was another one of the pilots where I worked at. And we traded out that way. It was worth it, you know. Then I started progressing on in my aviation career and started making more money, and then there was more money and more things to drink and more things to do, and drinking and you know, a lot of other stuff became a very big priority. And during that time I met my first wife and had a baby, beautiful little girl. And you know, it was more important for me almost all the time to be in a bar. I was a bar drinker. And that's what I do. You know, I'd get off work, and, you know, if you did what I did for a living, and if you flew the junk that I flew, and if you'd blah, 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 you'd drink too. And I got pretty good at it. And pretty soon, it's, you know, 5 in the morning, you go home, take a shower, you know, back out to the airport to go to work, and just day after day of that. And, you know, my wife was telling me things like, you know, the booze is getting in the way. I remember one time she took my little daughter down to, the local bar and put her in the window and had her ask people if her daddy was in there. I was real proud of that. She really just didn't understand. You know, what can I tell you? But as I say, my drinking just kept getting more and more and more and more. And I had a few issues with the airport, with the airport police. I got stopped 9 times for drunk driving and never got one. Back in those days, the cops just didn't, they just get off the road, you know, let me give you a ride, whatever. The worst one was in Dutch Harbor, and I had just got there, and I'm driving down the road in this big old Pontiac Bonneville or whatever it was, and there's a set of headlights coming at me, and there are no paved roads there back then. And I thought it was the owners of the company's cousin. So I thought, well, we'll just play chicken. You know, and I'm right in the center of the road, and when the car coming at me swerved and went off the side, I looked out the window, and Christ, it was the cop. I remember, you know, he started talking about, well, you know, do you know how many people died in Vietnam? And I said, you know, I don't know. I was in Canada. It doesn't bother me, you know. And then he started going on to some other big tale. He was going to tell me about, you know, drinking and driving. Finally, I just put my hands out, and I said, look, if you'll just shut up, just arrest me and take me to jail. You know, leave me alone. I don't want to hear you. And he kind of looked at me, and then I told him, I says, just so you know, I'm the only medevac pilot on this rock. So if I'm doing my 3 days, because that's what the rate was then, if I'm doing my 3 days and you get a medevac, they can die. You know, and I put my hands out, and he just turned around and walked away. And at that point, I knew I owned Dutch Harbor. You know, every time we got drinking, I had to drive. You know, once again, that's not what Matt had in mind with their designated drivers, but that's how we handled it. I got hired by this little airline that was starting to get big, and we got 737s, and it was just the best. It was the cream job of the world. I mean, you're home every night, flying brand new equipment, and you know, I'm starting to miss Monday trips, and Tuesday and Wednesday, and yeah, and this just kind of going on a little bit. The chief pilot's kind of looking at me, and my wife is. She's gonna start talking to the company about my drinking, and it's progressed to that point. And at that time, I was going through a very intense school on the 737. You have to learn every nut and bolt and switch on the thing, and you have to go through all this. And then at the same time, I was negotiating a contract as a pilot for the pilot group with the company, and you know, drinking like a fish. And it all came to a head where we won this contract, and they let us, you know, we had this big party is what it was, and it was on a Tuesday night. And right on, you know, so I got that party, and I started drinking, and then everything goes out the window like it always did. And, you know, the next morning when I came around, I had missed my flight. I stranded 109 passengers in the terminal because everybody else had called in sick. I was the only one that didn't. And, you know, I was on the block to get fired. It's as simple as that. I went to the company. They fired me. And they kind of gave me a caveat to come back. It was kind of like, it talks about in a big book. He says, you know, do you want to make a lot of money and fly airplanes or do you want to drink? You know, and that decision, right, that hard decision. And I fought it. I started to fight it. I hired an attorney, and I'm talking to this attorney about, you know, how this thing is going to play out and all this stuff and how the company's just screwed me because I was a negotiator and all this other stuff. Have you ever been talking and hear yourself and you go, Jesus, that's stupid? Well, yeah, that's what happened. I just, you know, it was just, I couldn't believe what was coming out of my lips. And, you know, the attorney told me, he says, you can win the case, probably take you 5 years, cost you X amount of money, and you won't get your seniority back, and all this other stuff. And I just went to the company and fell on my sword. And they offered me a chance to get into a rehab deal that called a HEMS program. I was the 997th pilot to get into that. So that's how I showed up here. You know, I had to go to a treatment center, I had to do this, I had to do that. Talk to psychiatrists, psychologists, doctors, and I hate all those people, and I don't want them to know anything about me. I always stay under the radar, except for with that. I have a file about that thick at the FAA. And, you know, I ended up in this treatment center, and I had this really odd feeling that last night that when I woke up, when I came to, that I'd finally tore it. I'd done it all in. I could never, you know, I mean, it was over. It was just over. It's a really funny feeling of completion. I don't know what that was. I do now, I think, you know, but it was there. And I stayed sober for 2 weeks while we were dealing with the lawyers because I was afraid to drink. I was absolutely scared to death. I gave up my family. I gave up everything for drinking. And the only thing I wouldn't give up was flying. So that's how I got here. I ended up in this treatment center and there was a guy that he was a friend of mine. He was a real mess. This guy really had a problem. We delivered him 2 years earlier to a treatment center and threw him out of the door there and said, "Here you go," you know. And you know, and I hadn't seen him for 2 years. And as I'm walking out the door to go to the company to my decision of what's going to happen, this guy was walking in the door, and he says, "Whatever you do, go to a 12-step program and a treatment deal." And I'm, well, what is that? He said, don't worry about it, just do it. And, you know, and I listened to him. So I ended up in a 12-step deal. I went to my first AA meeting there, and I learned a lot of neat stuff in treatment. It was a lot of, they've had names for everything and how everything worked and why I was that way, and it just didn't make sense to me. But when I started going to the AA meetings, I started hearing people that I understood, and that's what got me in here. Sandy said, we want to talk about spiritual experiences. I think my first one was that little feeling of completion. I really think that was the beginning. That was where it's, you've finally done it, now what are you going to do? And so we get in there, and I remember I was flying a DC-6 one time. It's an old World War II four-engine transport airplane, and they're only supposed to go up to 21,000 feet, or actually 19,000 because it's a cargo airplane. We were at 26,000 feet flying over Mount McKinley, and I'm with two Bible thumpers, I'm in the middle of my disease, and one of them is talking about the rapture when all the Christians are going to get sucked off the earth and only the bad guys are going to be left. And I've been listening to this, right? And here's what I thought of God. I told these guys, if that happens in the next 45 minutes, don't depressurize the airplane when you leave. So that ended that conversation. that was my kind of concept. My idea of God was, as I'm going down in flames, and the window's full of rocks, and I'm going to hit, I'm going to stick my hand up, and I'm going to say, okay, God, if you're there, save me. Otherwise, I'm not going to waste any time. And if you're not there, you won't save me, and it won't matter. I didn't waste any time. And that was pretty much my concept. I get in this treatment center, and I've been avoiding this God thing all along, and we got to the third step. And that was part of the deal to get out of there. So I had to make a decision. I literally had to make a decision. Go figure, And I knew that if I opened that door, that because of some other things that happened, that I was going to have to actually do the deal. I was going to have to start acknowledging. I was going to have to turn my will over. And that's pretty much what happened. I got in there, and when it came around my turn and all this stuff, I'd gone to my room, closed the door, covered myself up over in the bed, and went, okay, God, if you're there, help me. That was my first prayer. And then went back out and checked my horoscope, and it was good. So I've been sober ever since. that was the beginning. But with that beginning, I started trying to pray. I skipped meditation because that was way over my head. I didn't understand it. But every morning and every evening, I started doing that. And, I'm sure I've missed some, but never intentionally. It's part of my routine. I'm a routine kind of guy. When you fly, you have ways you do things. If you do them the same way all the time, you have a lot less chance of making a mistake and crashing, And so I do things that way. And so that's what I did. Come to the 11th step, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact, And so, I didn't know what to do with that. Because I didn't want to think, when I flew with these other two guys all the time that I was talking about earlier, they were always, praying before we started some tight approach or going up some river. And I would just stop that, That's just making me nervous, And so I told myself I'd never be like that. And what happened was I find myself going, okay, God, your will be done, And I started saying that. And I started saying that all the time as I'm driving home. Like I said, I'm very mechanical. There's one exit where a bunch of friends live at. They're all in the program. And I'd say, okay, God, I do the serenity prayer or something like that. And keep going. I still do it every time I drive by that deal. But I wanted to start getting communication, right, with the higher part. That's the only thing I knew to do. And I figured if it worked in flying, it might work there. I think it has, I have a friend, he told me one time, he said, when you're 37,000 feet, and you look out the window, and you're chasing the sun across the Pacific, and it's sunset, and you get all these beautiful colors, and all this, it's unbelievable. It absolutely is. And up until that point, I always put something over the windshield because it was always in the way and bothering me. So I started taking that down and looking at that and enjoying it. And some of the most beautiful sceneries in the world, the Northern Lights, are just absolutely unbelievable. That makes your, like when Amazing Grace played, my skin goes like that. Same thing on the Northern Lights when it's a really beautiful night. You know, I get to see those things and enjoy them. You know, they talk about the sunlight of the Spirit. That's what happens when I do that. Probably the other, I've made a couple decisions in my life that were based on my superior knowledge of airplane systems and everything that was going on. And I had a really bad deal one night where the airplane was on fire, literally, and the cockpit was on fire. And I had to get this thing on the ground, you know, and I forget what it was I did. But I knew in my mind, because I knew the airplane so well, that what I did was right. And I got on the ground, and this mechanic looks at me and he goes, "God, you're lucky." I go, "Well, what do you mean?" He says, "Well, tell me what you did." And I told him, he says, "You should be dead. You don't know crap." and I'm still here, you know, and we made it. And I've had a few of those kind of things. That's, you know, it's a heck of a life. I love it. I have a 5-year-old granddaughter. Actually, I'll go before that. I don't run out of time here. My now wife had 3 kids when I married her. And one of them's a boy. He was 18. On his 18th birthday, he got thrown out of the house because I threw him out. He got busted selling drugs at the high school with his young sister with him. So I drove him down to the Brother Francis shelter and said, "You want to live with these people? Here you are." And I threw him out. I figured he'd beat me home. You know, I was wrong. He was really tough. He stayed out for 7 years. Did a little jail time, did a bunch of stuff. 2 tours through Adult Salvation Army Adult Rehab before he finally got it. And probably one of the neatest moments of my life is when he called me up and we did the 9th step together. You know, and I found out all the stuff I lost too. It was great. to watch him now, he started 2 meetings in Anchorage. He's got a car that's full of drunks all the time moving them around. And to watch that's amazing. It's just absolutely wonderful. You know, because if you want to know if someone's going to make it in AA, you can ask me and say the opposite of what I tell you. And that's what will happen, because I knew he never stood a chance. He was never going to make it. And he's just been amazing. He had a daughter, and we're adopting her right now. And we're going through all this court stuff to do all that, you know. 60 years old. Who's going to raise a 5-year-old? You know, that was not on the radar for my life and what I was going to do when I grew up, you know. And it's the most, one of those, "Gee, Grandpa, I just love you" moments is worth all the sobriety. I have 2 grandsons by my daughter that would never talk to me again. And she, I get to take them, they get to spend the night, they get to do all kinds of stuff. You know, and that's all because of the program and working the spiritual deal. I'm no giant guru or anything like that. I'm just a regular guy. You know, and that was very important when I got sober, because my first sponsor told me, he said, "Listen, you go to regular meetings regularly, you're not that special." You know, and I have. Sandy started, helped start the Birds of a Feather group, which is for airline pilots. And it's a great deal. When I get new guys that are pilots, I take them there for a couple meetings, and then we go to regular meetings. You know, so that I think that's extremely important. I'm probably using up all my time here, but I just want to say thanks, Sandy.
Thank you, Mike. I've gotten to know Mike pretty well. I've been up to Alaska and he flew me around, and he's my kind of pilot. He's down on the ground chasing people in sleds and everything, and that's the way it ought to be. Our next gentleman is going to share. I've known a long time, back when I was in Washington, D.C., and I was a great admirer of him. He just has a real good way about him, and it always was a pleasure to just know that he was my friend. Come on up, Lauder.
Hey group, I'm Lauder. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. I'm 65 as of yesterday, and I've been called many things in my life, but never maestro. My wife will fall down laughing when she hears maestro because I don't dance. The beginning. The beginning was I drew an ace. Basically, growing up, I was born to a pilot, test pilot. He was a Yankee, married a Southern Belle. They had four children. I was the third one, second son. Boy, girl, boy, girl. And to make this, to shorten this up, I will say just the early part. I loved my brother. Not so much my sisters. My older sister kept trying to keep me away from my older brother because they were like, they split up the family, older and younger. So I was pissed off at my younger sister for being boring because it put me with her. But I was always crazy about my brother. And my father, who wasn't around so much because of his work. But I grew up, I grew up in this family. We wanted for nothing. And I just never, as I look back, I just never had the knack for living. And you read about this in the literature. If I wasn't doing something exciting, that was either excitement generated by me or somebody else, but something to get the blood level up, I was basically unhappy. And for no reason whatsoever, as I say, I wanted for nothing. And I was supposed to be the bright one in the family, which was a curse. And I must have gone through 8 schools between the time I was in 7th grade and the time I finally finished high school. I get kicked out, get sent away to school, get kicked out, get sent away. And the my mother, let me put this in here. My mother was raised us in that religion where they have women in wire rim spectacles wearing medieval costumes wandering around with tri-cornered rulers prepared to beat the tar out of you if you misbehave. I was introduced to a god that was supposed to love all of us, but not you, you wretched little heathen. And this was a god that killed my grandmother on Christmas Eve. You know, there was just a lot of stuff. So I grew up with this idea of a higher power who was theoretically loving, but was like the sort of all-seeing, pitiless eye. And this religion encouraged fourth steps. And the recipient of one of my last fourth steps in this, through the screen, came this incredulous priest's voice that said, "I find it hard to believe that a child of your age could be doing these things." So anyway. So about 14, like everybody else, around 14, I had some health problems, and they put me on drugs, which changed everything. And while they worked, I was focused, and things made sense. And that was the beginning. And my brother was 4 years older than me, so he was drinking by this time. And the damnedest thing, I adored him, and the damnedest thing happened to him. He'd drink and half his face would melt, and he'd start speaking in strange languages. He was a terrible drinker. I couldn't figure out what was wrong with him. And I also couldn't figure out why he kept doing it. And I found out in short order, was a great drinker. I could drink with impunity. I drank all night. And I never had hangovers, unlike him. I thought, this is terrific. I'm an adult, and this is something I do well, and it's fun. And drinking for me made my ability to hang out and interact with other people great. I was carefree, amusing, interested. Thought I was really interesting, you know how that goes. And And so it went with me as I got older. My school career was blotchy. I went down to the University of Miami to become an oceanographer because I had always loved the undersea. University of Miami in those days was undergoing an experimental educational program. It was a waste of time for me, so I got on my motorcycle and went west and ended up getting all my diving licenses for hard hat and scuba and underwater demolition, and that wasn't exciting enough. So I the war was coming along, and I burned my draft records. It was 4F, and I joined up as a paratrooper, and went through the service, went through jump school. To my brother's just astonishment, he also had become a pilot. He was one of FedEx's first pilots, and he was one of those, why would you jump out of a perfectly good airplane, you moron? And I loved it, and I didn't realize that was a long time ago. I didn't realize that it would be a great analogy and help for me in AA, because jumping out the door of a perfectly good airplane is very much like, you know, the leap to faith. And in this particular case, you're hoping that the fellow who packed your parachute knew what the hell he was doing, which I came to find later was not necessarily the case, because I wandered over there one day to see those guys, and they were all stoned. And I thought, whoa! But I loved that. I loved it. I got sent to Germany. I was waiting to go to OCS, and because they had too many lieutenants then, and I said, "To hell with OCS!" I just sent me over to Nam, and the idea was that I was going to go over there and die gallantly. I just didn't have the knack for living, and that didn't work. And I came back rather surprised. I felt like one of these actors who's been prepped for a one-act play, and he does the one act, and before he can get off the stage, the curtains come up, and everyone's sitting there waiting for the second act to begin, and I had no lines. And I was desperate. I was desperate. I'd lost a bunch of friends just before I left. I felt guilty as hell. And that seeking that Sandy talks about, I really started. But my way of seeking God was, first of all, I was furious at this celestial psychopath. And I started taking, you know, all the booze didn't do it. I was taking all the drugs I could, and I was going to, you know, manhole cover size LSD deals, and to find out what the answer was, because if there wasn't an answer, I was out of here. And I was very, very careless with my life. And what happened after about 2 or 3 months of this was one night I got an answer. I had this incredible spiritual experience, and it wasn't the way I was looking. I don't know what direction I was looking, but I felt like I was yanked by the back of the collar and put into the immediate presence of something so vast that I was aware that I could not begin to comprehend it, and also something so loving that it calmed me down, and it said, what it said to me was, you know, you are loved and it's going to be okay. Now, 75 years ago today, anniversary, the 12th of December, was the day that Bill, as all the historians know, Bill had his great transformation at Towns Hospital. The wind blew through and so forth. It's an interesting thing. So I had one of these too, but what I did instead of starting a great organization to help like my brother, I said, I am loved, and now I'm going to call up 1-800-RAUL and get into the Snuffleupagus and really ruin my life, which is what I did for the next 17 years. And that was, we've all done that spiral. Bad marriages, quitting, things getting better, then things getting worse again, and my brother got caught cancer, died when he was 40. I was again off to the races with this bastard, and you know, how could you have taken the wrong brother and all this stuff? And I was I led the kind of life that you will, you know, that we read about in the book, and ended up in a little house in the suburbs in Washington, literally living on Freebase and tequila, my two major food groups. I don't advise it. And I'd eat every Wednesday. I'd have a can of Campbell's Chunky Roadkill or whatever the hell. It didn't matter. It was hard to eat. And here's what happened. Here is the elegant kindness of God. This is where it gets exciting. A poor girl, had come down to see me, who thought she knew me anyway. She had no idea what she was getting into. And by this time, I was spending a lot of time by myself. And I took her to the airport at the end of the weekend, and I thought I'd stop in this bar in Washington for a drink. It was a long way back to my house from the airport, about 20 minutes, so I needed to stop. And so I stopped for a drink, and I ran into this guy I'd known for on and off for a long time. And he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm, you know, sitting at home smoking Freebase, staying up 3-4 days at a time, playing music and reading books. What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, that sounds good to me." And I didn't realize that he'd been bopping around the program for years at a time. Anyway, he came over, stayed with me for 2 weeks. During that time, and then fled in terror because he was sure he was going to die. And during that time, I said, "Whatever happened to your sister?" Because people had said to me, "You know, I'm surprised you and Abby aren't together. She's a real player," and so forth, and our paths never crossed. And he said to me, "Oh, you mean Miss AA?" And I said, "Well, what the hell does that mean?" Although those are her initials, because her name is Abigail Adams. And he said, "Well, she doesn't do anything anymore." And I said, "You know what? Not even champagne and Valium, which everyone knows don't count." And he said nothing. So I said, "I'd like to go see her." And he hemmed and hawed. I found out later he was trying to be protective of his baby sister. But anyway, I finally talked him into going over to see her. And I was trying to think what it would be like. I'd known people who'd quit, who'd been real players, who'd quit before. But they all looked like, you know, cats on the clothesline, you know, or they were Grinches, and it just seemed, why bother? Why bother if you're that miserable? Well, she came to the door, and there was something I could not put together about her, and that was she was not only clean and sober, she was calm and at peace and serene. And I could not figure out how that worked. What followed was an illicit AA romance, because she had not even 3 years yet, and I was in terrible, terrible straits. And she was going to 3 meetings a day just to kind of keep it together. And she finally worked out some deal where there was an intervention, and I got sent off to a. She got my father involved, which I said was really unfair because I had no defense against him, and sent me off to this treatment center. And my God, after a few days at the treatment center, I'll tell you what happened first. I drank all the martinis on the plane going out. I was so screwed up they didn't bother, you know, it didn't make me drunk. And but I smelled interesting. I could tell by the cab driver's expression on my way to this place that he knew he was taking me to the right place. They said, "This is your roommate, and he'll show you around." And I was, as I say, really burned out. Anyway, he showed me around. I put one foot in front of the other, and the day ended, and the lights went out. And I was lying there looking up at the ceiling, knowing that the sprinkler system had a camera in it. And this voice in the dark said, "Can I see the gun?" And I said, "What gun?" And he said, "The one you're going to use to kill me." And I thought, fuck, I am home. I thought, you know, if this guy, because this guy had been there for a couple of weeks, and I thought, this is good, this is good. So what happened was, slowly but surely, the clouds lifted, and I remember a succession of small miracles. One of them, I remember the day that I looked back to realize that I had not thought about having a drink or a drug the day before. And I remember the day sitting there reading the 12 steps, scanning to see which ones I would be doing. And I remember this vividly. I remember thinking, you know something, this could actually work. And they insisted you do a fifth step, fourth and fifth step there, which I was grateful for. This treatment center was in the desert in California, to which added a certain biblical aspect to what I'm going to tell you. So they had me do a fifth step, and the carrot with that was everything that you can get out is gone. You just can't beat yourself with it anymore. I was very good at doing that. And so I did this fifth step. The guy had the temerity to almost fall asleep. He must have been on Thorazine because, of course, you know what I was telling him was the worst stuff that's ever been done. But he did say on the way out, after I'd done my fifth step, I didn't feel any differently. And he said, "Where are you going now?" I said, "Back to the dorm." He said, No. He said, "Go walk around in the desert for a while and remember that God has forgiven you for everything you've done and you have to forgive yourself." That was huge for me. And I came back, east a different person. All of my thoughts, I was 41 then, everything I had thought about life, what makes a man, what makes you brave, was wrong. I thought bravery had to do with physical things and fear of death and so forth, and it's not that at all. I was more terrified in early sobriety, and I have been terrified actually since. I've gotten successfully married. We've been married 21 or 2 years. I have a 20-year-old daughter and only child, and I have gone through more things from my 40s, 50s, and 60s than I ever went through when I thought I was leading a fast and furious, exciting life. And I've been blessed because, as Sandy said, he was back in Washington when I got back east, and my then-girlfriend said she'd been shopping meetings for me in Washington, and that there was this great guy, but he was about to leave town. And I thought, just my luck. And so I started going to hear him on Saturday mornings, thinking this was going to be his last time. And luckily, he stuck around for a while. And I grew up on AA in Washington with Sandy and his other classmates, Ed and Hal, and a lot of other great people in Washington. And boy, the mind reels. I have to say that the getting back to the God part, when you all told me, "We suggest," I love the word suggest, it's just got to be one of the most weighted words in the English language when it's used in AA. "We suggest that you try our God, our higher power. And our higher power, as was articulated by one of us, is, you know, omnipotent being that wants our happiness more than we do and knows how to go about getting it better than we do. That's all you have to know. And I thought, I can hang on to that. And I hear these little nuggets in AA, which really hit me and have helped me to this day. I think of a couple of them. One of my favorites is God gives and gives and forgives, and we get and forget. And that's, you know, and that's one of those. A little too close here. Another one that helped me out so much was God answers prayers three ways. I heard this early on because I was planning to win the lottery now that I was clean and sober and could really be responsible with the glue. That God answers prayers either yes, not right now, or no, my child, I love you too much for that. And that when I heard that, I thought, that's the reason I haven't won the lottery yet. I've heard, I used to keep a book of, I still have it, but of things I've heard that have helped me at first myopically working my way through through faith in a loving higher power. And as I got more into the program, able to stride more purposefully or sure of myself through faith. I do have to add a caveat to that, which Sandy brought up yesterday. There did come a time in my program, probably around 10, 11, or 12 years, where it happened so subtly. Unbeknownst to me, I went from being a child of God to a young adult of God, possibly on my way to an adult and co-helper of God. And I noticed that my prayers were not sort of supplications. Would you please, you know, if it be thy will, would you do this? It was, hey, in case you haven't noticed, because of Bosnia and Afghanistan and so forth, the following things need to be done here. And the way I became aware that this was happening was that my peace of mind and joy, which had been so great in the program, started to lessen, and it made me very nervous. I was told a couple of things when I first came in, and one of them was, you must go to meetings. And what they had told me when I got to out to treatment was, if you want any chance of surviving, you know, you have to be honest, open-minded, and willing, and you have to chase this thing as much as you chased your drug of choice. The latter I immediately discounted because it was absurd to think that I was going to stay up, you know, 4 days at a time going to meetings. But I took their point. And the honest, open-minded, and willing part, for me, the first among equals with those was the willing, because my mind when I came into the program looked like Dresden in 1944, and so I couldn't. It was open to the air. And honesty, I thought, was cash register. And you all told me, no, that's not the case. That honesty, there is emotional honesty as well as cash register honesty. And there's spiritual honesty, which is be right with this God. This is not a punishing God. I come down to these retreats to be reminded of that. I've been seeking all my life, I'm aware, for a loving God, and I have had moments when, when I felt an incredible presence of God, almost overwhelming. I felt one of those in this room with Sandy speaking. I went to see the Dalai Lama in Washington, and the energy in the room was so incredible that I wanted to burst into tears. That kind of tactile thing for an addict alcoholic, it's my immediate thing with that, of course, is I want more. And that's where you all have helped me so much, is saying that you just be grateful for what you have. You can't have that all the time. Somebody gave me a quote by a German named, I think, Friedrich von Hugel or something, and it said, all this trying for an, you know, intimate, tactile relationship with God is so much puerile trifling. And those Germans. And my experience, which is why I was so interested to hear about Sandy Singh with what he's been going through, is there have been times in the past 23 years where I just did not feel any spiritual headwind, and I was doing everything I was supposed to be doing, and I checked with people and, you know, talked to sponsors and so forth, and I just did not feel that connection, and it scared the hell out of me. And any of us that have been around long enough know that, you know, this disease takes a lot of people out, and they all go out thinking that what they're doing is logical. Except the ones that commit suicide. And even they, I guess, even they think that that's the next career move. But I've come to understand for myself that those periods, unlike the spiritual rush that we may get from a weekend like this, those periods are part of the deal, and it's sort of a spiritual gymnastics. A spiritual strengthening tool I've come to find for myself. That it's easy if you can feel God's presence right next to you all the time to be on. If you're vectored on all the time and it's almost, you know, it's almost like booze. I mean, it feels good and it's right there. And if you had that all the time, if I had that all the time, where would the growth be? And those periods, those, you know, week long or whatever, 2 week long or however long they are, periods where there isn't any sense of that, are just for me not reasons to become terrified that I'm being pulled out in some way, but rather periods of growth, of strengthening. And I've also noticed that, as it says in the literature, to keep it, you have to give it away. And I love the fact that that I was taught that the way that works is, you know, the difference between the Red Sea and the Dead Sea is one flows out and the other one holds everything and is lifeless. I love working with newcomers in AA. Newcomers have been drawn to me that I never would have met in normal life. Of course, I've met everybody in AA, people I normally would not have come across in normal life, which is one of the great benefits of it, the fellowship. And it is nothing if not an adventure. I have to mention his name because his path and mine crossed briefly when I came back to Washington in the mid-late 80s, but Buck Doyle used to say, hell, this shouldn't be called Alcoholics Anonymous, it should be called Adventurers Anonymous. And that was music to my ears at the time, because when I got on the plane to go out to the treatment center, I thought I was done. The only thing taking me out there was that I wanted to be with my girlfriend again, and I knew I couldn't if I was dead. And she wouldn't stay with me if I was still using, so I had to go out and get clean and sober. But I was also sure, you know, that voice whispered to me that there will be, you know, there's not going to be any fun anymore. This is going to be a gray world, you know, no fun sex, no adventure, no zippity-doo-dah, nothing to stimulate the adrenal glands and so forth. And that was just one of the, I've come to realize, just one of the one of the slyest lies that that alcohol tells us to try to keep us from having a stake run through its heart on a daily basis, which is coming to the program. My heart is so full of gratitude for being here. I can't tell you. It's an honor to get up and talk. I thank Sandy for asking me, and Merry Christmas to you all. Thanks.
Well, before we wrap this up, I want to tell you guys one more time what it feels like that you chose to come here. I mean, up until your faces are here, it's a idea. You know what I mean? It's a theory. It's, wow, wouldn't it be nice? And then as you started arriving, and then I saw, wow, I just tell you, it means so much to me that you chose to do this. I mean, I just can't thank you enough. And that's all for this.